I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
The next chapter.
Fiction enables us to wrestle with our grief and our anxieties.
We did see a man with a tuna head in the basket of a bicycle.
When you're the outsider, it's tough.
The next chapter.
On CBC Radio 1
and Sirius XM.
Short stories, despite what some might believe, are not training wheels for a writer's inevitable novel. They are their own form with their own conventions. And luckily, in Canada, prize juries have always treated them as equals. We also have a robust prize system. I was recently a judge for the Toronto Star Short Story Contest, and the CBC has been running its short story prize for decades. The winner of that was announced last week. And you can go to CBC Books to read the winning story and those of the finalists as well. Which brings me to our first guest today. Carly Baker won the City of Vancouver Book Award for her debut collection of short stories called Bad Endings. And in a few minutes, I'll speak with her about her new collection, Last Woman. The Dartmouth, Nova Scotia writer Elaine McCluskey has four short story collections to her credit. Her last one, Raphael Has Pretty Eyes, won the Alistair MacLeod Prize for Short Fiction. The Gift Child is Elaine's latest book, and it's a novel. She'll speak with our contributor Ryan B. Patrick about that in a half an hour. And to close, CBC Books associate producer Annie Nguyen recommends three novels that reveal all the complications of life as a second-generation child. I'm Ali Hassan. Welcome to the next chapter. Bad Endings may have been the title of Carly Baker's first collection of short stories, but Good Endings described its post-publication success. It was a finalist for a number of prizes, and it won the City of Vancouver Book Award. Now, 7 years later, Carly has published a second short story collection. It's called Last Woman, and in these stories, Carly brings her irreverent point of view to a cast of characters who are struggling with the worries and weirdness of the contemporary world around them. Carly is of Cree, Métis, Icelandic descent, and she joins me today from Vancouver. Hi, Carly. Welcome back to the next chapter.
Hi, Ali. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Now, I say welcome back because you were here before for that this book, Bad Endings, that I mentioned. You spoke with Sheila Rogers about how many of those stories were autofiction or almost memoir. This collection, Last Woman, you have a very large cast of characters. So tell me about this change.
Yeah, when I finished Bad Endings, I was happy with the choices that I made with that book, obviously. But at that point, I was very interested and eager to talk about myself, I guess, to tell my own stories. And some elements of autofiction are quite challenging, one being that obviously, yeah, that you're on display and also the characters in your stories are real life or perceived as real life characters from your family and friend group. And when I finished with that, 7 years ago, ages ago, I had a lot of time to think about the fact that I think I was ready to exercise my imagination a little bit more, to work on creating worlds that were beyond my lived experience. So with Last Woman, I made a specific choice to sort of turn my attention from the navel, the gazing of the navel, to the world around me.
Hmm. The Toronto Star review of Last Woman mentioned anxiety and nostalgia as themes that stood out. And those are two things I definitely felt as well. How are your characters feeling in these stories? And maybe also, how are you feeling when you wrote them?
Yeah. I'm going to try not to use the royal we here too much because, of course, it's not right for me to talk about how other people are feeling. But it's kind of nonstop hellscape right now, really, and isn't it? Like, it's just sort of from one thing to the next. And over the course of writing the story, some of the stories in Last Woman are old. Some of them are from the era of Bad Endings, and a few of them were drafted throughout the, I guess one in particular, during the lockdown period of the pandemic. And I was feeling, aside from being very anxious about sort of what past, present, and future, I guess, I was also feeling quite blocked because I was working on a project, a bigger project that wasn't going anywhere. And so there's a lot of vigorousness in the way that I wrote those stories that was sort of designed to help. Writing isn't therapy, in my opinion. Therapy is therapy. But there was a therapeutic element in writing those stories in that I had a lot of fear inside me. And there's different ways to cope with your fear. Some people maybe feel angry, use anger as a way to cope with their fear. And I do sometimes, but I do have a problem with what is it, righteous anger and outrage, in that sometimes I turn it on myself, I turn it on people around me. I haven't really yet figured out what, say, activists, some people that I really respect, have the ability to channel anger into action. And instead, I just sort of, anger just sits around inside me. So I was feeling fearful, and as a result, I was feeling anger. And then on top of all that, I was blocked. I couldn't write. And so when it was time, what I eventually had to do was switch away from the bigger project and go back to the stories. And that I feel that really came through. Those characters are nervous. Those characters are feeling isolated. They're lonely and sad. And some of the characters are quite wrongheaded, I think, in their view of the world. They're wrestling with this sort of influx of post-truth, things like fake news, and also just not knowing. They don't know what's next, and they're having trouble accessing any kind of information about what's next. And that's certainly the way that I was feeling in real life. Might not be autofiction, but that's the way that I was feeling in real life, and I think that's how those characters are feeling.
I should mention for our listeners, you said it was time to get away from the bigger project and write these stories. The bigger project, you mean a larger novel that you're working on?
Yeah, my next book will be a novel, but I was working on a different novel project, actually, that I had gotten really into this mindset of you need to work on that or nothing. And I don't know why. No one made me feel that way. And so when the going wasn't good on that, when that just wasn't coming, then I just worked on nothing. I just sat around and felt nervous about about writing. It was a real misstep. Talk about wrongheaded. That was definitely a misstep for me.
You know, you mentioned outrage that you were feeling. It made me think of this story, Outraged on Your Behalf, and also another story, Displacement. Both of those stories are about homes that are destroyed by fire and flooding. Were those specific events in your life that got you thinking about that?
Yeah, there's a lot of me in both of those stories, or maybe also a lot of my family as well. Outraged on Your Behalf is about a fire and about a character who takes her parents in after being evacuated for a fire. And Displacement is about a couple of characters who are seniors who are displaced due to a flood. And both of those events happened to my parents. They live in Merritt, BC. And so I guess I believe this was both in the same year. The floods were quite famous. There was some catastrophic flooding that occurred in BC. And it wasn't just Merritt. It was throughout the province. Areas of the Coquihalla were smashed. And it was quite big. And so with Outraged on Your Behalf, the parents have been, they have to leave. And I remember waking up at 9 o'clock at night one night, and a phone call at 9 o'clock at night from me is unlikely, but from my parents, it's unheard of. Absolutely unheard of. We're an early to bed, early to rise family. And so there had been a phone call that came in from my dad, and I couldn't reach them, but I checked the news. I'd been following the situation with the fires there. At that point, when I checked, every road out of town was blocked due to fire. so scary from my perspective, terrifying from their perspective. And fortunately, it was only about 40 minutes before one of the highways was cleared. But at that point, we'd been in touch daily. And I had said, you know, I think you should come down. I think you should come down ahead of the evacuation order. Please come down and stay. And I mean, I think it's very easy to read my work as very serious. But my coping mechanism is humor. So that was a terrible situation, but the absurdity of that situation was that my family came down. In real life, it was three family members, my parents and my sibling, and stayed in my one-bedroom apartment, which offered little comfort. But except for that, you know, we got to be together throughout that time. And the character in Outraged on Your Behalf gets on Twitter and posts something that isn't accurate about her family's situation, sort of out of a, it's like a cri de coeur, and I mean, just I'm angry, and but she doesn't tell the truth about their situation. Well, that's not something that I did. I think I had already left Twitter for good at that point, as a matter of fact. But that feeling of helplessness was something that I wanted to capture, and I also just had been thinking a lot about anger on the internet, so I chose to express it that way.
Speaking of these situations your parents found themselves in, and the fire, the flooding, it's like, my God, all you need now are the locusts to make it like completely a biblical thing. But climate fiction or cli-fi, as it used to be on its own, is this separate category. But it seems that now it's a subject, at least in some form, that is either in the background or the foreground in just all fiction these days. It's the reality of our world. It's so unavoidable. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I definitely consider myself or an element of my writing to be climate fiction. And it sort of seems to me like it's almost impossible, I guess, as someone who writes very place-based. I write about what's going on around me, and I write about the environments that are familiar to me, that it seems impossible for me to write stories without including elements of climate fiction in there, or climate change. I mean, it's not fiction. It's weirder than fiction. It's uncanny, and it's upsetting. So it just seems natural to include that. And I guess I'm also thinking about readers, too. I thought a lot writing Last Woman about how I hoped readers might feel at the end of reading those stories. And of course, you know, it's my job to take you on a ride, go dig into the places that might be uncomfortable and upsetting at times. But I sort of hoped that there would be a chance maybe to purge some of that. I don't think that climate fiction is going to change the world. I don't think it's going to heal the environment. But I do think that climate change fiction enables us to wrestle with, in particular, our grief and our anxiety. So that's sort of the most I think I can hope for with my stories, is that it might allow the reader an opportunity to say, yeah, I've been feeling that.
You know, on a different note, there's a story called Catechism. And I think I connected with this too, because I've been teaching a class every semester for the last few years. Catechism features a prof who ends up supporting elements of the ivory tower status quo. And I thought it was interesting also, she's very snobby about genre fiction, you know, and you've been in the ivory tower. I'm not sure if I should put quotes around that too, but you've been there, you teach creative fiction. What have you observed there?
Yeah, there's definitely some sass in that story. And I felt sassy because I have been teaching, and that story too, it's another reason to distance myself from autofiction, is that I that's not a single institution that I'm pointing my finger at in Catechism. But I do want to point out that structural racism is a major problem in educational institutions in post-secondary, and that part of that is this equity and diversity, which is a good movement and a movement that has created a lot of change in universities. But it's also very easy for those in power, I feel, to just sort of adopt that term and then just sort of pat themselves on the back. And I have to say us, I've been a part of that myself, in that if you teach there, then whether you like it or not, you're a part of that structural racism. So it's easy for us to pat ourselves on the back and to feel that, well, that's it. Okay, good. We've done enough. We've hired some teachers of color, and I've been the teacher of color. I've been the only Indigenous person in a meeting filled with professors who are simultaneously communicating concern about the need for change while doing nothing over and over again. And I tried to, once again, I saw the situation as darkly absurd. So I took the story in a direction that was supposed to be quite ridiculous at the end. I mean, quite over the top. And for some reason, I can't exactly explain why, but I tied the snobbiness about genre fiction, the elitism about genre fiction that you do see at educational institutions, that there's a, this is something I will say from my actual experiences, that one of the first classes that I taught, I asked the students what they wanted to write, and that most of the students, at least 70% of the students, wanted to write genre fiction. So as a literary, I'm using finger quotes again, as a literary fiction writer, in my view, there are some basic skills. I can add some value to a student's education through some of the skills that I have that I think are important. But say something like economy of language. I mean, you've seen fantasy books. Fantasy books can be 900 pages long. Fantasy books can be 12 900 page long books. And so for me to stand in front of a group of students who are talking about economy of language, I don't know. I worried a lot. I had a lot of guilt about whether or not and questions about whether or not I was serving them, and also some confusion about why we don't see more genre writers teaching at universities. Maybe they want no part of it. I don't know. But that's what the students really, that's what my students wanted to write. And we did our best in those classes. But I suspect that there's some elitism at play there. And it's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. There are three connected stories called Billionaires 1, 2, and 3. They feature women billionaires trying to head into space. And you take a look at from the alien perspective, and in the three stories, aliens are looking down, observing Earth and these women billionaires and their space dreams. What do they see?
Yeah, I mean, I cannot be the only one who thinks about that at times. Like, what on earth would aliens think if they were to look at our absurd situation right now?
A lot of eye rolling. I think there's a lot of eye rolling going on up there.
A lot of eye rolling. I agree. So I thought about it from that perspective. The story, the initial draft of the story, very much I had this alien character that was like a booming voice speaking from above saying, people of Earth. And that was, thank goodness for editors. I was led away from that idea. And I just let my imagination go. I thought a lot about Douglas Adams while I was writing these stories. And just absolutely love the way Douglas Adams handles aliens in general, or alien planets. And this idea of imagining aliens not as less spooky and human-esque, I guess, in the way that they converse and the way that they are looking at us right now. In my view, for the story, for the sake of the story, that we are like children. Earthlings are like adorable children to aliens. I really wanted there to be a lot of condescension and as you say, a lot of eye rolling.
Speaking of eye rolling, this is semi-related at the very least. There's a story called Alpha that features young girls stressing over the fact that another girl who they perceive to be prettier than them is getting a lot of attention. They're plotting to take her down. No one really likes to admit that they feel jealous publicly anyway, especially as intensely as these girls. What was the spark for that story?
Yeah, I do like to dig deep when I'm writing my characters. And I do like to dig into some uncomfortable parts of myself. I'll just be honest. The opening to Alphas was basically a journal entry, something that I wrote after an evening out. And that feeling of jealousy and pettiness, and that this is another example of a very wrong-headed character, obviously. This is not a hero, not a likable character. But that, yeah, I'll own it, I'll admit it, that came from my own wrestling with feelings of jealousy. That's part of my process, I guess, is digging deep into some of the more uncomfortable parts of my own personality and then just going with it.
I want to end on a lighter note. I have to ask you about you being a bunny enthusiast. I saw that picture of Oliver the Bunny on your bio page. Apparently, he is the winner of the City of Vancouver Majestic Floop Award. Tell us about this award and this bunny and how famous he is.
Oh, well, okay, I got to come clean about that. We made that award up. That award doesn't exist. He is a majestic flooper. I know. That's you blame my web designer, who's also my husband, Sean Cranberry, because it was actually Sean's idea to add Oliver to the website. But I've got to say, that has got me. I feel like in the old days, Twitter used to get me a lot of play. People would say, "Hey, I saw your tweet, and I'm interested. Let's talk, or come on my show, or do this and that." And so now, with Twitter no longer being a part of my life, it does seem like Oliver has stepped forward to be my champion. And he is truly a majestic flooper.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I mean, who needs social media when you have a beautiful bunny like that? You've figured something out there, definitely.
Agreed.
Thanks so much, Carly. Congratulations on this book.
Thanks, Ali. Thank you for having me.
Carly Baker is the author of Last Woman, and she joined me from Vancouver. Today is Canadian Independent Bookstore Day. It's a cross-country initiative to promote and show support for books. We checked in with a couple of stores around the country to see what titles are popular in their regions.
My name is Chris Hall. I'm one of the owners of McNally Robinson Booksellers. I've worked here for more than 27 years now, hard as that is to believe. We have a large 25,000 square foot store on Grant Avenue in Winnipeg. It includes a full service restaurant. It has been here for more than 27 years now. So it's really established itself as a community bookstore, but community by definition is all of Winnipeg. And we have an equally large store and restaurant in Saskatoon. And we also have a smaller store in Winnipeg. It's at the Forks, which is where the people of Winnipeg, as well as our two rivers, meet. I like to wander all over the store when I make recommendations. So let's start with a novel, though. A new novel by a Canadian named Shilpi Samaya Gowda. Her new novel is called A Great Country. She's an author we're very familiar with, as she's visited us a couple of times. And this new novel is about the Shaw family. They're now just newly moved to a place called Pacific Hills, California. And it's a gated community with ocean views and well-tended lawns. The move is supposed to represent a culmination of years of hard work and dreams, but things take a turn. Their young son ends up in the county jail, and suddenly this family is forced to face the differences between them and many of the other residents of this new neighborhood. It's nuanced, it's beautifully written. It asks those kinds of hard questions, but it remains heartwarming and ultimately graceful. The next book will go to our children's section. One of our favorite authors, David Robertson. He has written a new book called The Kodiaks. He's one of our favorites because he's very local to us in Winnipeg. He's a regular customer as well as a frequent centerpiece to our author events. So this new novel, it's intended for intermediate readers. It features Alex Robinson, and Alex has moved from his indigenous community into the city when his father accepts a new job. And then Alex joins the Kodiaks, and that's a local hockey team, and he proves himself one of the best players. But he also becomes a target because he's indigenous. So the story is about him learning to trust his teammates, but also learning to stand up to the jerks on the other team. And it draws on Robertson's own experience. He tells it in a very compelling and entertaining way, and it's great for readers, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous, to learn about the world and the multiple kinds of people that are in it. The last one I'll go to nonfiction. This is a little more of a challenging read. It's called Our Crumbling Foundation, How We Solve Canada's Housing Crisis, and it's by Gregor Craigie. And Craigie has gone around the world talking to local experts, tenants, owners, homeless people across Canada, who are straining, as lots of people are, under tightening financial pressures. And then he goes a little farther afield and he examines how other North American cities and other international jurisdictions are housing their citizens. Some of them are doing it better and faster. And he suggests that these are some solutions that could be put into practice here, because this is an ever-increasing crisis that we're facing, and housing should be a basic human right. We find that people are up for the challenges of reading books that help us figure out what's happening in our world, and this would be a perfect example of that kind of recommendation.
My name is Pia Flamand, and I work for Inhabit Media, which is an Inuit-owned book publisher. Inhabit Media started in 2006 because there were no resources for Inuit kids to see themselves in books. So our co-owner started making books for that. And we've grown like exponentially since then. Now we have an office in Toronto, an office in Iqaluit. And we recently opened a bookstore in Toronto at 612 Mount Pleasant Road, where we stock exclusively books from the Arctic. Picture books are our most popular books at the moment. And the first one I wanted to talk to you about is Sweetest Kulu by Selina Kailuk, illustrated by Alexandria Neonakis. This is an all-time bestseller for us. Everybody loves this book. It's a beautiful bedtime poem describing gifts given to a newborn baby by all the animals of the Arctic. It's a really great gift for new parents. And then the next one is Benny the Bananasaurus Rex, which is written by Toronto-based Inuit author Sarah Beth Holden and illustrated by Emma Pedersen, who is based in Hamilton. So this is actually a very local Toronto book as well. It's a funny and relatable story about a little boy who loves bananas and dinosaurs so much that one day, using his imagination, he turns into a Bananasaurus Rex. And finally, a new book that we're very excited about is I'm a Rock by Ashley Killavaksavard, illustrated by Pellen Turgot. It's a bedtime story about all the things a child's pet rock sees, hears, and feels in his Arctic home. It's an Arctic journey from an unlikely perspective, a rock. It's publishing in early April, so we're going to have lots of copies on hand for Indie Bookstore Day, and we can't wait for everyone to read it.
That was Pia Flamand from Inhabit Books. And before Pia, we heard from Chris Hall. He's the president of the Canadian Independent Booksellers Association and co-owner of McNally Robinson Booksellers. We'll be back after these messages.
I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. You understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, my name is Catherine Hernandez. I'm the author of my upcoming book, Behind You, and you're listening to the next chapter on CBC Radio 1.
My colleague Ryan B. Patrick is here now to tell us about the interview he has on today's program. I know the author's name is Elaine McCluskey. She's from Nova Scotia. She has a few books to her credit. What else can you tell us about Elaine and the book that you and her are going to talk about today, Ryan?
Yeah, so Elaine McCluskey, she's an award-winning acclaimed novelist and short story writer from Dartmouth. Her work tends to explore what it means to live in Nova Scotia, what it means to be from the Maritime region. And that's true with her latest novel. It's called The Gift Child. It's her seventh novel. It involves a missing person. It involves a tuna head in a delivery bike basket. And the missing person's cousin wants to know what happens. And this sets in motion a mystery involving petty criminals, undercover agents, a potential UFO sighting, and so much more. It's very sardonic, it's very witty, and it essentially looks at the nature of memory, the nature of grief, truth, and what it essentially means to be a good person.
Very nice. Remind me what the name of the book is again?
The Gift Child.
The Gift Child. All right, let's hear the chat. Ryan B. Patrick in conversation with Elaine McCluskey.
Elaine McCluskey lives in Nova Scotia, and that's where she joins me from today. Elaine, hello. Welcome.
Hi, Ryan.
How's it going? Well,
it's just great down here.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. Let's talk about down here. So you live in Dartmouth, correct?
I do. I live in Dartmouth, yes.
And you clearly know Nova Scotia like the back of your hand. Can you describe the landscape as you know it and its effect on you as you grew up?
Yes, I did grow up in Dartmouth, and I think that shows through in my writing. I'm very versed in the people, very versed in the place. And Dartmouth revolves to a large extent around the lakes. So we have it's called City of the Lakes. I think there's over 20 lakes, and they're not only a source of recreation, but they're a source of sporting events and family events. So there's a lot of history behind the lakes, and they play an important role in the city.
Mm. Let's talk about your new book. It's called The Gift Child, and it opens with a man who goes missing, and it also involves like a giant tuna head in a bicycle basket. And as this book unfolds, it's witty, it's sardonic, and it had me chuckling to myself. Like, tell me about the elevator pitch for this book.
Yeah, okay. So the tuna head, that was a real thing. We did see a man with a tuna head in the basket of a bicycle. So the premise of the book, the premise of the book is the narrator is a woman named Harriet Swim. And Harriet's, like many people of a certain age, life is fine. And then her glamorous husband leaves her. She loses her job. Her mother, the good person in the family, dies. And then the oddball cousin Graham disappears with a tuna head in the basket of his delivery bicycle. So it's starting to pile up for Harriet. And she asks herself, what's wrong with us, the Swims? There must be something there, she decides, genetic or environmental. So Harriet has a very strong suspicion that her father, Stan, a local celebrity, is the problem. He's responsible for everything that got them there, and that may or may not be true. So the book unfolds with Harriet trying to find out what happened to Graham and the tuna head, but really trying to find out about herself and her family.
Let's talk about the character of Harriet Swim. She's a headstrong photojournalist. She's currently out of work, and she's trying to find out what happened to this missing person who happens to be her cousin. Why is she so determined to get to the bottom of this case?
I think to an extent she's kidding herself. She's kidding herself that it's important for her to find Graham when she's really finding herself. Her life's turned upside down. She liked her job as a photojournalist. She liked being married. And all of a sudden, she's displaced, and she's going to, while looking for Graham, she's really looking for herself. And she does, without giving it away, she does find some of herself in her journey because she used to be a very skilled street photographer. And she lost that part of herself, too, when she got into midlife. So she rediscovers that in the book. And then she also meets a mysterious international man of mystery. So that happens in the book as well.
So this is like a maritime novel through and through. It's set in the small fishing village of Pollock Passage, and the actual conceit of the book is Harriet is actually writing this narrative as if it's a memoir, and she's clearly grappling with the nature of truth, memory, and as you mentioned, even her own identity. What did you want to explore here with this kind of metatextual kind of narrative?
I think the truth is very untrustworthy and very flexible, and Harriet is an amateur writer, but she's writing like a postmodernist writer when she doesn't even know what postmodernist is. So she believes that truth is flexible, and so I play with that in the book, and I believe that not everyone gets the truth they deserve. So sometimes I try to fix that. And I think that there has to be room in life for mercy, forgiveness, even a little bit of revenge. Mm-hmm. And besides, people don't remember life accurately anyway, or they invent their own truths. So I'm playing with that in the book.
And what I like about how you play with truth and fiction is that you weave in these like kind of real life events, such as you mention a factoid about the Boston Bruins, or you mention how the Halifax municipality was amalgamated. And then you kind of go on your way telling this fiction. So you ground it in these truthful elements, which I really appreciated.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I took a little bit of a risk doing that, but I'm very happy with it. I have my fictional characters, Harriet and Stan, and then I have real people in the book, Sidney Crosby, mm-hmm. Brad Marchand, I have, Joel Plaskett. I have real people in the book as well. So I think that made it for a somewhat unique book, and I was very happy with the way that came out.
Mm. You mentioned Stan. Yeah. So Stan is Harriet's father. And what a character this guy is. He's like a former broadcaster. He's a bit of a blowhard. But Harriet just kind of puts up with him. Tell me mm-hmm. about Stan and his relationship with Harriet.
If Harriet's life had gone the way she had hoped, she probably wouldn't be spending so much time with Stan. Mm. He can be funny. He was very good at his job when he was a broadcaster, but he's a bit much, and he is a borderline narcissist, and he can be an amusing person, but not a terribly nice person to be around. But Harriet is spending time with him because she's at loose ends, and she also is using him as part of the basis for this memoir she's writing. And I thought it was funny when she's planning on writing this memoir, she's in a writing workshop, and the instructor says, well, you should tell your father you're doing this. She goes, he wouldn't care. She goes, he's not going to care. He's not going to read it, and he's not going to care. So she feels like she has carte blanche because Stan's ego is so big that he's not going to read anything she writes anyway. Mm. So she writes with impunity about Stan. And when she's doing this, she does find out some truths about Stan, which I hope give readers a little bit of empathy for him, because we find out some things in his past that weren't fantastic, but he can be totally ridiculous. For some reason, he has a real bug about the old participation ads from the 70s, and he goes on a mad rant about those.
Mm. And as the story unfolds, there's a mystery. It's like undercover agents, there's petty criminals, there's a possible UFO incident. What's mm-hmm. the key to keeping the story grounded, given all these chaotic elements?
I think what keeps it grounded is Harriet. Mm. And this is Harriet writing this book. And Harriet's life is not linear. Harriet's thoughts are not linear. So these are the hurdles that Harriet's jumping over when she tries to get to her truth and her story. And I think that my writing is a bit uneven and bumpy because I want it to mirror life. So I don't have Harriet going on a straight journey from A to Z. I have Harriet taking some detours and going down some rabbit holes that don't necessarily give her what she was looking for.
Mm. And it goes back to what we were talking about. Like your body of work explores like these real life events in the Maritimes, and you're exploring like offbeat characters, subcultures, dialects. That seems to be your jam. Like why is that something you're compelled to write about and explore?
I guess maybe that's how I grew up. I'm not sure. My dad was a pretty unusual guy. My dad was a boxer who trained boxers. We did own a monkey. probably
I like
illegal.
How you casually just added that.
It was probably illegal. It was definitely a bad idea. So we had a monkey in the house. My dad, there was, boxers coming right and left. You know, he trained Trevor Burbick. He trained all kinds of interesting people. And I liked things that were interesting and colorful and real. And people talk a certain way that appeals to me.
Yeah. And given all these elements, there's a lot of heart here. There's a character in the book who notes that some people are born with a protective coating around their heart, and some have more of this coating than others. And that's why some people are more cold in the world than others. How did that kind of insightful idea come to you?
I'm not sure how it evolved, but it's something I firmly believe, because when you get to a certain age, everybody around you has something sad or traumatic happen to them. And some people, they just walk through it and they carry on with their life. And other people are so shattered and broken, they're operating at 50 or 30% for the rest of their lives. So my theory is that some people are lucky that they have a thicker enamel than others, and they're able to withstand tragedy in life. Now, Stan in the book has the hardest enamel ever because nothing touches him. Graham goes missing and he worries about it for about a week and then he carries on.
Yeah.
Whereas other characters have thinner enamel and they're more devastated by life's tragedies.
Mm. You've been quoted as saying, "I believe the Maritimes has its share of voiceless souls trying to maintain their humor and dignity in a challenging world." And I feel essentially this book is about the Maritimes and Dartmouth in particular. Yeah. Why is that?
I'm an observational writer, among other things, and I live here. And I do strongly believe that humor here is a huge coping mechanism. It's something people during hard times turn to. It's something that gets them by. And my belief is if you can make fun of something or laugh at something, it loses its power over you to an extent. So when bad things happen, if you can somehow find a way to see the absurdity in them, then they become less painful. Maritimers are good at that.
I like that. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Yes, thank you so much.
That was Elaine McCluskey in conversation with Ryan B. Patrick about her new novel, The Gift Child. Living with one foot in and one foot out, neither here nor there, teetering on a seesaw, these are balancing acts second-generation offspring know very well. It's a challenge to hold on and connect to your parents' world and culture when you've grown up embracing your new world. There's a lot to unpack here, as we say in public radio, and fiction writers are doing just that. CBC Books Associate Producer Annie Nguyen has been going through a stack of books on this subject, and she's here now to recommend three that tackle the subject in fresh and interesting ways. Hi, Annie. Welcome to the next chapter.
Hi, Ellie.
So I'm guessing you can relate to this subject personally. I know that I can, certainly. First off, give us a mini primer on second-gen kids in Canada. What are the stats?
Yeah, so second-gen kids, by definition, are kids who are born in their native country, so Canada for me, but whose parents were born elsewhere. So one or both of your parents were not born in Canada, and that makes you a second-gen immigrant. Even sort of 10, 15 years ago, second-gen kids made up a good sort of 17, 18% of all of Canada's population, so it's pretty sizable. In Toronto especially, that's upwards of 33%, 34%. So obviously, as our population has grown over the years, that's either remained steady or just continued upwards.
I think there's a lot of shared experiences that second-generation kids share, even if they're from different generations. How do you see that balancing act of second-generation children?
It's a fine line to walk, I think. When you're a kid, there's a lot of instincts to resist the life or the expectations that your parents have for you, right? They've come from a different country. They're not used to the language or the customs that you're growing up in. And so it creates this sort of friction between you. But especially for me, as I've gotten older and I've reflected a lot on it, I find myself wanting to bridge that gap with my mom and dad and my family a lot more.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. So many people come back to their culture later on. I can definitely relate to that, where you sort of ran away from it, almost embarrassed at some stage. And then you're like, oh, we had a good thing going here. There's a lot of good that I should have been leaning into. There's a wide range within this second-gen experience. And I know the books you've picked out today go from macro viewpoint to a closer look. So let's start with the first book on your list. What is it?
Yeah, so the first book is called Portrait of a Thief by Grace D. Lee. I should say that it is the book that I built this column around because I was just very excited to read it. It's about a group of five Chinese American students who are all, you know, in very high levels of education and study and who are hired by sort of a slightly shady Chinese company to steal back Chinese artifacts from various museums around the world.
Yeah, I should mention that this book, instant New York Times bestseller, is it because of the theft? Is that what people are excited about? Why are they stealing these artifacts?
So for all of the characters who are coming from different diasporic backgrounds within Chinese culture. Some of them are very much leaning into the idea of reclaiming their own culture, right? So to them, the fact that these Chinese artifacts live in non-Chinese museums is a tantamount to theft, right, to them. And so for them, it's about the reclaiming of their cultural heritage. For others, you know, they're promised $50 million, and that for them is a life-changing sum, right? A lot of them send money back to their parents or their families to help support them, or they are kind of struggling under the expectations of being kind of that, not a breadwinner, but sort of that really successful child.
Mm-hmm. Repatriating looted treasures to the country of origin is a very big issue right now. I listened to this podcast, Stuff the British Stole, very, very popular. So how is this issue of repatriation handled in the novel?
Well, it's handled via theft, which I think is pretty interesting. I found it really cool the way that the book talks about those struggles in the sense that China's tried to be diplomatic about it. They've tried to, in the context of the book, have tried to ask for these artifacts back, to purchase them back, that sort of thing. And this is sort of their feeling of last resort. And why they choose these specific kids to do this, I think because they have that sense that these kids want to be part of that reclamation. It's a point of connection to their culture that is hard to really grasp when you're, you know, a Harvard studying art history at Harvard and you're reading about these things and looking at them all day and thinking, well, I'm part of this institution and this culture that is stealing from my own heritage and my own culture, and it creates that internal struggle.
Above and beyond these pretty serious issues and themes that are at work that you're suggesting in Portrait of a Thief, we also should recognize that it's a heist book, which suggests it would be exciting and fun. How well does the book manage that heist angle?
It does a great job. It revolves around the five points of view of the main characters who all play a different role in the heist. So it dives into their specific aspects, the planning, the getaway driving, the, you know, system hacking. I love a heist. I love the meeting of expert minds in a common goal and seeing all of their different perspectives and expertises come together, sometimes well, sometimes in conflict, just makes for really interesting reading.
Great. All right. What is the second book you want to talk about today?
The second book, which I know that you have talked about before, is Sunshine Nails by Mai Nguyen, or Mai Nguyen. I know she was a Canada Reads longlist pick this year, so I won't get too much into it, but it's a book about a Vietnamese family in Toronto that owns a nail salon, and their business is sort of struggling. It's just about their family dynamic as they work through that together.
Yeah, we had Mai in studio. I got to check out her own nails, which she was a little bit embarrassed about. Very interesting story. I really enjoyed it. The adult children in Sunshine Nails keep big parts of themselves hidden from their parents. You know, and this is the big takeaway I had from the book, which is often a second generation technique, approach to family life. How is that handled in Sunshine Nails?
I mean, it's handled in the sense that that's kind of the way it happens. And in certain moments, there is resolution where, you know, the kids and their parents come together to understanding. But certain secrets in the book don't necessarily come to light. And I thought that was really interesting in the sense that just in the same way our parents do, they hide things from us in order to protect us and protect our feelings and our childhoods. I think second-gen kids do the same for their parents.
Specifically, this is a Vietnamese family. You are a Vietnamese. That is your background. How did you connect to that part of the story?
Oh, I definitely connected to it. It was a bit strange, to be honest with you, because I would read the Vietnamese phrases to the best of my ability in the book, and I would hear my mom and dad's voices, which I found a little bit disarming, but really interesting. There's a lot of very specific Vietnamese cultural nods in the book, specific foods, specific phrases that really shocked me. It was strange to see them on the page and to think about other families sitting down to my favorite meal. But I really, really enjoyed that. It was nice to see this quite sort of modern take on family, which is the situation that I live in, you know?
All right. Tell us about the last book on the list.
The third book is called Frankly in Love by David Yoon, and it's about a Korean-American teenager who, in an effort to go out with this girl from his school who is white, pretends to date his Korean friend in order to, I guess, get his parents, you know, approval.
Also an instant New York Times bestseller from what I know. And so this is like very contentious issue, dating outside your race and culture for many families. How does this character, the lead character, because they're named Frank, right? Mm-hmm. Frankly in Love is Frank. How does Frank manage his parents' expectations?
I mean, he manages them by deceiving them, which...
So not well, maybe.
Not well. Yeah. It is a choice, but it's definitely something that I recognize that struggle. I think for a lot of second-gen kids, it's a question that you raise to yourself and to your own parents as you get older and you start to think about those things like long-term relationships. And for some parents, it's sort of a non-issue, but for others, it is really a way of, for them, I think, preserving their culture and keeping that going. It's interesting to think about it now as an adult versus when I was young and thinking about dating. When you are on the outside of a group, a relationship, a family, and you are kind of the other person, you are the person of color, you're the immigrant, you're the outsider, it's tough, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think about your parents wanting someone who shares your culture and your heritage, partly because, you know, it would make them more comfortable or your family more comfortable, but also I would think that it would make that your partner more comfortable as well in certain ways. Do you know what I mean? Because they are then being the othered person and they are on the outside.
Sure, sure.
And that can be difficult too.
Sure.
So that's just something I've been thinking about.
As you talk about this, you know, I'm the father of a young woman, a teenager, a preteen, and they are third generation. And I think about teenagers who try to figure out who they are. This is like their big time where you search for your identity. That's a big theme and of the characters in these novels that you've brought in today too. Did you draw any conclusions about that identity puzzle as you read these books?
Yeah. Have you ever been to that Infinity Mirror exhibition? There's one at the AGO, I think, but it was touring.
I know it is a Kusama exhibit. I haven't been.
Essentially, you're in a room full of mirrors, right? So you are getting reflection, your own reflection, and then reflections of your own reflection over and over and over again. Mm. And my parents' bathroom used to have those folding mirrors. Mm. And I would do that. I would stand there, fold the mirrors around myself, and I would look at my own reflection to the infinitesimal.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of see identity and second generation identity like that. You can see yourself, and as you get further and further away, it doesn't look like you, but it is you, right? So figuring out the parts of your identity that fit together, that feel like your own, but that truly represent who you are as a person, and kind of piecing that together for yourself is really what's most important, because I think that because everyone's experiences are different, everyone's sense of the diaspora is different, right, that the puzzle is not going to look the same at the end for everyone, right? But as long as the pieces that you're putting together of yourself and your culture fit together for you and in a way that makes you feel, you know, whole and comfortable and hopefully more certain of yourself, then that's ultimately the goal.
Thanks, Annie. It's great chat, and thanks for bringing in these books.
Thank you so much.
Annie Nguyen is an associate producer at CBC Books, and the titles she was talking about today are on our website, cbc.ca/thenextchapter. And that is it for today's program. Jacqueline Kirk is our senior producer with Lisa Matthews. Aaron Balzer is our executive producer. My thanks this week to Laura Antonelli, Trevor Carter, Charlene Chow, and to the CBC Books digital team. Coming up next week, Nadine Sander-Green on her coming-of-age novel set in Whitehorse. It's called Rabbit, 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 and it looks into the fallout from an intense love affair that tips into the toxic. And sci-fi writer and activist Cory Doctorow answers the Proust questionnaire. I'm Ali Hassan. Thanks for listening to The Next Chapter.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.